It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast,
where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry, routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready? Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and ideas and then get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the networking world with humour, wit and just possibly technical talent as well. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so please send an email back to packetpushers@gmail.com if you've got something to say. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments there. Follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/packetpushers. Let's introduce the people on the podcast today. Today, we're going to be looking at internet exchanges. One of our listeners wrote in and said, Greg, I'd like to hear a whole bunch more about internet exchanges and the like. So what we've done is gone out and found a couple of people who are dead set into internet exchanges virtually as a full-time. So I'd like to introduce Stephen Wilcox. Stephen, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me on the show. I've been involved in peering for the past 12 years, working with iXReach, Google, Renesas, Telecomplete, Opal, TalkTalk, and Via Networks. I'm director of the London Internet Exchange for the past 7 years, and I've also been involved in other iXs in official and non-official capacities in Europe and America. I don't really show up much on the blogosphere or tweeting, but if anyone wants to get hold of me, it's steve.wilcox@ixreach.com.
Ah, thanks very much, Steve. And well, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for taking some time out on the weekend. And also on the show this week is Russell Heiling?
Feeling.
Feeling. Sorry, I got that wrong last time. Welcome back, Russell.
Yeah, cheers, Greg. Well, I was here last week, so I did my bio then, but I'll do it again. I'm Russell Heiling. I've been working in as a network engineer in ISP networks for going on 15 years now. I'm on Twitter as @xjutoix, and I blog at pearlmonkey.blogspot.com. You can keep up with what I'm doing there.
Thanks very much for coming back, and thanks for helping to organise this show. I really appreciate you taking the time to get in contact with Stephen and work with me to get it all set up. Well, let's get straight into the content and talk about a peering exchange and internet exchanges. And perhaps I think the first thing is perhaps to tell people what peering exchanges are. I think, Stephen, do you want to lead out on that one?
Sure. So what is peering? So I looked this up because I wanted to give an answer. So I Googled it, and the first hit was Wikipedia. So according to Wikipedia, peering is a voluntary interconnection of administratively separate internet networks for the purpose of exchanging traffic between the customers of each network, which I have no idea really what that means as I say it. So in simple terms, it's when two networks basically come together and they exchange traffic that's only destined or sourced within their networks and their customers' networks.
So that would normally be corporate entities then?
It would be any service provider or corporate or essentially anybody who operates their own autonomous network where... By definition, I mean that they have their own autonomous system number, AS number. They have their own IP addresses. They're running their own BGP, and they're directly taking transit with an upstream provider and running BGP for that, as opposed to sitting within a provider's network where none of that stuff goes on. You're just part of a bigger network.
Right. So carriers would have a backbone, an internet backbone generally, and they're running BGP, and they would peer with big companies like, for example, large .coms. So I could imagine a carrier like, say, Level 3 would be connected directly to Google as well as Facebook as well as, you know, other MySpace, and they would all be – but MySpace, Google, and Facebook would also connect to AT&T, cable and wireless, you know, whoever it is those big backbone carriers are at this current point in time. Is that more or less the idea?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, the way that the internet backbone works, there is no internet backbone. There's just lots of autonomous networks like the ones you mentioned. And at some point, those networks have to get together and interconnect. The smaller network may just buy transit from an upstream, but just not everybody buys transit from somebody else. It has to stop somewhere. And at some level, you have networks that are interconnecting and peering, and there's lots of it going on. All the companies you mentioned are doing lots of peering.
Well, it's always possible that even, you know, big sources of traffic like Google and Facebook actually talk directly to each other, have their own private links between each other. Peering is not necessarily between a carrier and an endpoint. It could actually be company to company, like endpoint to endpoint.
Right. It can be between any. I mean, once a network has made a decision that they want to start peering, and this could either be the a small corporate that has a very small private network, or it could be a very large company like a Level 3 or a Facebook of this world. Once they enter into it, they make some decisions about what their goals are and what they are seeking to do by peering, and then they go out there and work down a list of people who they want to peer with and go ahead and set that up. And of course, some of the networks you mentioned are pretty well established and very old, so they'll have pretty ancient peering links that they evolve over time. But as new players come on the scene, Facebook is an example, relatively new company, but you know they're expanding quickly. They go out there, they hire guys who understand the peering world, and they set their business goals out and target the networks that they want to peer with. And as you say, they may well want to peer with the level threes of this world and the sprints of this world, but they also want to peer with other content providers and anybody generally who needs to take packets to or from them.
Yeah, well, I guess there's many different causes. I mean, I imagine that Twitter, for example, has a direct connection into Google because Twitter produces a fire hose, and I wouldn't be forwarding those packets off over the internet. It'd be more efficient just to run a connection directly between the two companies, I would have thought.
Potentially. I guess so.
Okay, just jump in here for a second. I mean, essentially what we're talking about here is the internet. So even when you've got a peering between two networks, that peering may be going directly between those networks, but essentially that is still the internet. It's not going to be on some private network segment. The internet's built out of these peering relationships. It's just a big graph of these different autonomous system numbers. They don't necessarily need to be big guys either. I mean, quite a few enterprises may find for resilience purposes, they want to get themselves an autonomous system number and some provider independent address space. They may do that initially in order to get two upstreams to get some resilience, but there's no reason why those guys then couldn't go out and set up some peering with someone if they had someone they needed to exchange traffic with.
Okay, well, that probably leads us into a discussion about what's the difference between public and private peering. So, you know, what is the difference?
Okay, so let me take it simple. If you and I want to peer, we just need to find a location that we're both physically present in, allocate ports, put a cross-connect in between us, and turn up a peering. And there we go. We have a private peering between us. Private in the sense that it's just you and I, and it's our cable, and there's nothing else going across it.
Some sort of telecom service connecting our two networks.
Not even. I mean, we might just be in a data center, and your rack is next to my rack, and I plug my router into your router, and you know, there's just a piece of cable between it.
Yep,
simple as that. It's private, essentially. There's nothing else going on there. There's no other people involved. Mm. The other side of the coin is the public. And this is where you join the internet exchange, like the links in London. And in this instance, what you would do is you take your port, but instead of plugging it directly into the peer, you plug it into the internet exchange. Link, SAM6, DKIX, all these guys, they have their switches. And when you're connected to their peering LANs, you're physically connected to their shared Ethernet. And there's many hundreds of networks that are present here, and you can see all of these other networks across this LAN. So you still have to go out and speak to the peers to negotiate the peering and to negotiate the BGP and do the technical configuration of the BGP. But you can see them all through this single connection. So it's public in the sense that this one connection goes via the switch medium, and there's a lot of people on the other side of it.
So you're talking about switches. Is that because most of the connections these days are gigabit or better, or 100 megabits per second Ethernet as a WAN connectivity, or is that?
Well, pretty much these days, all public peering is done on Ethernet switches. And typically 1 gig, 10 gig, or a lot of networks these days even have multiple 10 gigs that are trunked together. And that's largely true of much of the internet. Most of it's done using Ethernet, but there's still some SDH out there. A lot of submarine capacity and capacity in regions such as Africa or Asia is a lot of SDH. So what you typically will have there is transmission networks that are SDH and maybe private peerings that might be SDH. But still, the internet exchanges are always usually going to be Ethernet.
And the somebody provides the router, but not the exchange that turns it from SDH into Ethernet, if you like.
Right. So the two instances I mentioned where they may have some SDH is either on their internal network, in which case they have a router between their internal network and the peering exchange, or if you and I are somewhere where the only thing that we have to connect between us is an SDH circuit, you know, STM4, STM16 circuit that we can have between us, then in that instance, I've got my router with an STM16 card and you've got your router with an STM16 card.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Russell, we were talking during the week and Stephen alluded to the fact that there's a lot of multiple 10 gigs actually being bonded together in these exchanges to provide internet capacity. And you were telling me that you're concerned that 100 gig isn't, you know, the upcoming 100 gig standard isn't going to be big enough.
Well, or perhaps not timely enough. I mean, if you look at some of the graphs of the exchanges that are running today, if you look at the busiest exchanges like DKIX, AMSIX, Lynx, these guys are already pushing. I think it's up to peaks up to about 3 terabytes at DKIX. So that's already well beyond the 100 gig standard, and there are quite a few customer connections coming into these large exchanges, which are maybe bringing in 6, 7, 8, 10 gig ports in a lag group just for one customer's connectivity into the exchange. So, yeah, certainly in the service provider market and the peering market, we're crying out for the 100 gig cards to become more available and more affordable.
Logically, you're actually even wanting terabit, which I don't think is even on the horizon.
Well, I mean, obviously the standards bodies are always looking to the future. I have heard some early rumblings about work on the next generations of standards, but as it stands at the moment, interface speed can be a limiting factor in some of these backbone networks.
Okay. Well, I guess that sort of talks to the actual physical connectivity. So it everybody's in a public peering point, which is what the Lynx and AMSIX and all those different businesses are. There's some big switches in that space which are running BGP. Yes, I'm waving my hands around and drawing pictures on the virtual whiteboard.
I think an important thing to point out there is that the big switches in the exchange, those devices aren't the ones running BGP. Basically, they're providing you with a layer 2 fabric to connect your router to someone else's router on the far side of the exchange. So the BGP runs between you and the peer. The switches in the middle are just forwarding that layer 2 traffic.
So what does the internet exchange actually provide? It provides a big layer 2 fabric for customers' routers to connect to?
I would say that's the core service it provides, yeah. I mean, obviously there are additional things that they will provide. Quite often they'll provide things like a root server, which is a device where you can basically set up one peering to the root server and you will get the benefit of the routes of everyone else who's connected to that root server. So that can simplify the setup of your peering sessions. And I mean, there's a lot of other benefits of being a member of one of these exchanges, which aren't necessarily the technical benefits. Certainly you get introductions to a lot of technologies if you attend the member meetings. You also get the benefit of these guys working on your behalf with on public affairs, things like that, attending public consultations about legal developments, things like that. So there's a lot of fringe benefits in the exchanges as well. It's not purely the exchange of traffic.
Some of them are other products as well worth mentioning. The peering LAN is the kind of the bread and butter and where these things come from. But depending upon your requirement, you may find that other services that these guys have to offer are useful. So, for example, there are peering exchanges just for mobile data traffic. There are peering exchanges for stock trading companies. There are private peering services offered, where some are for connecting to your peers within the same building so that you don't have to manage all that cabling. Others offer inter-building DWDM services. And obviously the advantage is that if you do all this through your IX provider, you're going to one place and they're providing everything for you versus all the hassle of trying to figure out how to do all that stuff yourself. So yeah, there's a good range of benefits that you get as well as the peering LAN.
So we've got, now that we're all connected at these points, we've talked about public and private peering. There's got to be some sort of settlement of who owns what. What are the financial arrangements? And you've told me earlier that there's a difference between settlement and settlement-free peering. So could you explain that for me?
99% of the peering that you're going to do, you're going to negotiate some peering with somebody, and they're just going to go ahead and set it up. There's going to be no contract. There's going to be no money involved, and life is going to be simple. But there are some networks out there. Maybe you ask them to peer, and these are typically like global networks. And when you ask them to peer, they're using peer in the literal dictionary sense. So they're saying, are you really comparable to me? And they may look at you and go, well, you see, I've got this network that spans five continents, and you've got a network that spans one building. I don't think this is really equitable. So we'll peer, but you might have to pay us. And so in that sense, you can do peering where there's money involved. And the concept is commercially very similar to transit. I mean, you agree to peer with somebody, they give you a rate, and you take a port and you get charged for it. And you may well ask, well, if it's very similar to transit, why don't you just go ahead and take transit? Generally speaking, most networks are not going to be getting too involved with settlement peering unless they're very large and it's a very niche area. So I would say, don't worry too much about it.
If you're talking about the difference between settlement and settlement-free, you'll know what you're looking for at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. If you don't know why you don't need it, you don't need it kind of thing. You'll just take an internet connection. Now we're connected up at the internet exchange, and there's got to be some sort of policy or process around this. So peering policies are going to be a part of this. So tell me more about that particular feature.
Peering policy, it's just your predefined way that a network handles any request to peer. There's an assumption here that when you went out into the world and you got your autonomous system number and you decided to join your internet exchange and go about peering, that you did it for a reason, right? You didn't just do it for fun. You have a business goal here.
Yeah.
So what is your business goal? And this varies. Every organization is going to have a different goal. And essentially, when you take these steps, you're going to know your goals. You're going to outline what it is you want to achieve, and whether you know it or not, you're defining your peering policy, whether you write it down or you don't write it down.
You might want to, so let's take that. So for example, I might want to be connected closer to the backbone so that my traffic gets faster if I'm an online business.
Yes, indeed.
You might want to get cheaper bandwidth, because if you're peering, it's cheaper than buying transit, or it might be cheaper than buying transit.
You'd hope it was. It's not always, but you'd hope it was.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a range of policies. You've got one end of the scale, which is open peering policy, which is, I just want to peer with everybody who's going to peer with me. I've got all this traffic, and I just want to offload it to everybody, and I'm happy to peer. And that's quite likely the kind of policy that you might have when you first enter the world of peering, and you're just not quite sure what you're doing, but you're just going to peer with everybody and see how it goes. That's fine. You peer with everybody who you can peer with, and you probably delegate this task to somebody internally who you call your peering coordinator. But the other end of the scale, you may be peering for a very specific reason. Maybe you've done it because you needed contractually to peer with a particular network out there, and you have no interest in doing any other peering. Or maybe you're a very large network and you already have all the peering you want and you don't want to do any more peering. So those guys are typically called closed or restrictive peering, i.e. they don't really want to do it, and you better come with a good excuse.
Okay, so let me try and make an example. For example, I worked for a .com business, which was basically focused on delivering content to companies in the UK, to customers in the UK. So in that case, you might take a closed or restricted policy to say, I only want to peer with the carriers in the UK because I want their traffic to go directly into those networks.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that an example that works?
It's an example. I would put that under selective. So yeah, you're open to peering, but only with a selective group of people. You don't want to peer with everybody, but you have your target defined.
Yeah. So I want to get my content to my customers as fast as possible, so I make sure I'm connecting directly into the British Telecom backbone, who has the biggest DSL network in the UK. So instead of routing it via three other autonomous systems, you know, three other backbone carriers to get there, I go directly into the BT network, and theoretically I've shaved 10 milliseconds off transaction of latency times.
Exactly. So, I mean, the textbook thing is that at one end of the scale you've got open peering and the other end of the scale you've got closed peering, but I think the world is actually a whole grayscale in the middle, and you're exactly describing what goes on in this middle bit, which is where basically everybody is.
Mm. Yep. I just want to translate it into a practical thing. So, yeah, okay.
As a practical thing, I mean, there's no hard and fast rule because everybody has their own requirements. What you tend to find out there is that the bigger networks are the ones who've got established peering and are less interested in establishing new relationships, and they may view you more as a customer than a peer. So you might find that the larger networks, the global networks or some of the large telcos, are restrictive when you come and ask them for peering. On the other hand, large content providers, they really want to get their content out to the end user. They don't really view you as a customer, and they really do want to see the quality improve to all their users, no matter who they are. So they tend to be a lot more open with their peering policies.
Okay.
Some common terms in peering policies are things like saying that if someone is already a BGP transit customer of yours, for example, then generally you wouldn't accept those as a peer, because that's going to make your routing a bit tricky there. It's probably going to make things asymmetric. They're going to send stuff to you over the peering, and you're going to send stuff to them over the customer connection. Other things that you quite often see in peering agreements are things like ratios between the amount of traffic sent versus the amount of traffic received. So some people might say, we'll only peer with you if it's within the ratio of 2-1 or something like that. And if you're sending 9 times as much as you're pulling, then we're not interested in you as a peer. Those are the sort of things that go in there.
I'd like to thank Escalta Training for sponsoring the Packet Pushers podcast. Escalta Training provides their an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States, who offer an array of Cisco courses on multiple technologies, including wireless, networking, routing and switching, CCNP, and so on. Using authorized Cisco course material and a strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and have consistently high satisfaction from their customers. Escalta provides training using various delivery methods to easily meet your unique needs across the US, and in addition to their extensive public class schedule, they develop private and client-specific training for your needs and environment. They are partners with Cisco for course development, and with well-known and industry-experienced instructors, they deliver public training courses and private on-site training. Escalta has the right solution for you. You can reach them on 1-800-297-4294 or on the web at www.escalta.com. And there's a blog at blog.escalta and on Twitter at @escalta. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class, and you'll receive a $250 discount to get you started. That's Escalta Training. They want you to learn something. So probably one last thing here is to talk about, although we talk about transiting traffic between networks, say, and I talked about reducing latency times for transaction stuff, we should also point out that there are content delivery networks from companies like Akamai and Cachefly and people like that, who actually cache content at the edge of the network. How do they work? Are they different from an internet exchange?
How do they work? That's a topic.
I know how the technology works, and I mean, obviously what they're doing is loading content at the edge.
Yeah, there's different ways to do it, and a lot of different ways. You're right. Typically speaking, what they're doing is they're bringing a lot of content, and they're trying to get it as close to the user as they can where they want to offload it via peering or transit, so that it gets to the user. In some cases, that means that they will physically put servers as close as possible to their peering ports and the internet exchanges. In other cases, it might mean that they have caches that are more centralized, and then they build a network out regionally to all the peering exchanges. But within this mix, you pretty much every big web property that you want to name probably falls into there somewhere or other. Many of the big web properties do this themselves, and I'm describing the models by which they may do this. A lot of them also outsource as well. You mentioned Akamai, and there's others like Limelight, CD Networks, and people like this who are content delivery networks specifically, in the sense that their business is to deliver the content for other people. So this is not their own content. This is other people's content. And people pay them to distribute this and deliver it using their own infrastructure. And those are what you're commonly referring to as content delivery networks. And these are guys that most of them are names that you wouldn't know if you're in the industry. If you're not in the industry, you know, these have probably the majority of the content on the internet, and many of the things that you download that you think come from your wellknown.com probably come from one of these content delivery networks, actually, when you come to look into it.
Yeah. So for those people who don't know, a content delivery network is commonly used to deliver very large files. So if you need to download a 100 meg file to a million people around the world, it's very difficult to build a server farm that it can actually stream that out. So, for example, you imagine when Apple next releases an update to their iPhone, how do they deliver a 500 meg file to, you know, 10 million people within 3 days? That's almost impossible to build a server that large. So these content delivery networks distribute that file all around the internet in hundreds of thousands of places, and you actually download it from within your, probably if you're at home, probably from within the DSL network of your provider. And they have very different networks. You wouldn't normally host your web pages in there, but you might host your images and your big file downloads and your PDF files and things like that. And they make accelerate the thing.
So you may host your website if you're a big brand. A lot of the big brands do this as well. You know, these days the world is the cloud, and more and more people are outsourcing what used to be a task 5 or 10 years ago that you would just go and get your own web server and manage and maintain it. These days, a lot of these guys actually do outsource it, just because then they get an SLA with somebody else, they get service guarantees, and there's a whole host of things they don't have to worry about. It's so simple and easy to do it, and there's so many guys doing this and specializing in it that, it may not be the majority of the traffic that's being served, but certainly a lot of the guys are using CDNs just to serve up their websites.
Yeah. I guess my point here is to understand the difference between using peering to accelerate your web performance, and maybe you need to be looking at your content instead of peering and deciding on a different strategy. Hopefully you would know the difference by the time you got there. But anyway, for the listeners. So exchange then some more about what are peering exchanges then. We've talked a little bit about why you would want peering and how some of the different peering works. So what are peering exchanges then?
Well, if I give a history on the one that I know closely, the links, the quick history there is that sometime back in 1994, the small handful of UK ISPs were in the business of buying international 64 kilobit lines to the US, and these things cost a lot of money. They had the idea, why do we keep paying all this money for this? We could just get together and exchange this traffic in London, and it wouldn't really cost that much. They got together, they discussed it, they figured it was a really smart move, and within a few weeks, they got an Ethernet switch connected up to it, and that was essentially the start of the London Internet Exchange. They mutualized the company a year later because they didn't trust each other, so they wanted to make sure that they had a company, but no one person was in control. So the UK Internet was kind of born and evolved, and this model is also the same one that then you see in so many other places, particularly around Europe. I think the interesting thing, looking back, is now it doesn't seem that amazing. I mean, internet exchanges are springing up everywhere, but you got to think, back in 1994, a company like British Telecom, which was most of the market back then, they actually agreed to interconnect and exchange traffic for free with their direct competitors in the UK. I mean, that's a crazy step. I mean, that's revolutionary. So those guys who were involved in it back then, and these guys are still involved in the UK industry today, they were smart guys. They did a lot for us. So
I think it made the internet possible, because it was extraordinarily difficult. I remember the US used to have a policy which forced traffic that came from overseas to subsidize the internet traffic that was in the country, and they used it as part of their telecoms policy to make internal traffic as cheap as possible.
That's business.
Well, it was actually government policy that forced the carriers to subsidize domestic traffic with international calls and things like that. Anyway.
So looking at it today, 16 years on, and you have companies like the Lynx, but they're not as pioneers. They were 16 years ago. Now it's an organization. There's rules, there's processes, there's standard price lists. If you've got a network and you want to start peering, you apply for membership, you order a port, and you're in there, and you're ready to peer.
Yeah, I mean, one point that Steve mentioned there, which is maybe something to expand on, the same that they're Lynx was one of the first, but if you look at the market now, I mean, in Europe, there's well over 100 exchanges spread across the territory. I think there are four or five just within London. There's a lot of choice there, and the traffic is just exploding. And we can see how good an idea it is now, but those guys really were pioneers to think.
Actually, I remember it. It was like rocket science back then. That day. Okay, so you talk about these internet exchanges being mutualized and shared spaces where everybody just joins together. But it seems to me that if you put that many different companies in one room, there's plenty of opportunity for politics and for personality. So how are these organizations run, and how do they resolve these conflicts of interest between different parts of the business?
So the membership organization model is the one that was used by Lynx and is used by quite a lot of other exchanges. And just to clarify what that means, it means that the company doesn't have regular shareholders. It's owned by its members. And when you join the exchange, you're a member, which means that you own the exchange, and you also get voting rights at the exchange.
So it doesn't have a profit motive generally.
Right, they're specifically not for profit. Nobody's taking dividends out of the company, and the other advantage of the membership organization is that you get stability as well, because it doesn't have an owner, which means that any changes that are being made, they get brought at the members' meetings, the frequency of which varies. Lynx has them every 3 months. Other organizations have them at different frequencies. But essentially, anytime they want to make a change, they have to bring it to the members and get a vote. So if anybody tries to do anything too radical or that's not in the interest of the members, then it won't pass the vote. And as you mentioned, it can be political. From the outside, people sort of look at the peering world and they see all these people, and there's a lot of the same faces that show up, and everybody seems to be quite friendly, and it all looks very nice. But, you know, peering itself is often about cooperating with your competitor, or if they're not your competitor, they may have a completely different line of business. You know, you're an eyeball provider, they're a content provider. So everybody's got their own business reasons why they're peering, and these are not usually the same business reasons as somebody else, or if they are the same business reason, you're dealing with your competitor. So there's a lot of decisions that may be some minor, some major. Things like, you know, does an exchange offer fast Ethernet ports? Should there be two LANs, and is it compulsory to peer on them? All these decisions have a financial impact that come back to a business. And when you're the peering coordinator and it comes time to vote, you have to ask yourself, what's right for my business? And you got to vote with what suits you, keeping in mind the wider peering ecosystem, but you've still got to sort of do it from your own business perspective. This does lead to some politics and can sometimes turn into quite big debates and issues on occasion.
Russell, have you had any experience of working with those organisations on a day-to-day basis?
Certainly I've been a member of a number of different internet exchanges and been present at meetings, voted, etc. I would say that the politics within the exchange organization, they're generally not that disruptive. I think largely that could be down to the fact that the attendees at the members' meetings are largely engineers and technical types rather than the business and marketing types. So they generally have a similar point of view on where the technology should go anyway. One area where you do come across politics certainly is when you're actually setting up your peerings. It can be quite a lot of work to try and convince someone that you should be a peer, or sometimes you even get some questionable practices with people maybe phoning up the NOC and saying, well, this peering session's not working, and the NOC guy sets it up, and then they find out, hang on, it wasn't even set up in the first place. And yeah. So suddenly someone's got themselves appearing through the back door.
That's a neat trick, by the way. I wouldn't try it these days, though. If you try it these days, those networks will laugh at you. But it has worked in the past, for sure. There's definitely examples of that.
Yeah. Well,
there was a lot of things that used to work.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it's like there have been examples in the past, like someone deciding to point a default route to someone across across one of the exchanges, so they can then send out all of their traffic globally via someone they're not even peering with. Obviously, that's a very very dodgy practice, and that sort of things you won't get away with that these days.
No, I think everybody's awake to that sort of thing, and there was a technological gap in the old days where. People didn't have a lot of knowledge or experience of BGP and peering and root control, and some people did it purely out of ignorance. I don't think it was even malicious to some extent.
And you still get that to some extent with people propagating routes that they shouldn't do. And there was the example a couple of years ago where an ISP in Pakistan was complying with government regulations to block YouTube, and then they released that route out onto the internet in general, and suddenly all of the traffic for YouTube globally was going over to Pakistan.
Yeah, I do think the government decreed something to be done, but I'm not sure the engineer who actually implemented thought through the impacts of that one.
No.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the technology that actually goes on inside an internet exchange, which is perhaps the most interesting part of the whole thing. So we've talked about exchanges having basically a big layer 2 broadcaster main.
Well, certainly any time you've got a big layer 2 broadcaster main, especially when we're talking about back in the days when these guys started out, talking 10, 15 years ago, building layer 2 broadcaster mains of the scale, then a lot of the advanced technologies that we use these days weren't necessarily available. So, for example, if you were building a network like this using standard spanning tree, then you've got a lot of issues there with scaling that network and making sure your links are properly utilized and things like that. These days, a lot of the time, the networks are built using a specific vendor and perhaps using vendor-specific technologies, so maybe using some of the Ethernet ring technologies from the guys like Brocade, Extreme, etc. In order to try and... the main problems that they... see are things like people introducing loops. Someone plugs a loop back into a port and starts sending frames back, and that can cause problems with switches falling over, etc. So there's generally on the edge there's some fairly strict rules about what traffic you're allowed to send onto the exchange, and a lot of layer 2 control protocols maybe. No goes there. Like you shouldn't send your CDP, your spanning tree, your VTP, etc. You shouldn't send any of that traffic onto the exchange. And if you do, depending on how the exchange is set up, you may get your port blocked for a while there.
Yeah, I'd agree with most of what's said there. There's usually some very strict rules for what can go on. It's common sense there, but it's not difficult technically to do this. You know, the exchange will just say that you can only send your own MAC address, you shouldn't be sending various link local things, and essentially if you're configuring your port as a layer 3 port, I mean, none of these things should become an issue, but it's important that you do abide by the rules. And as Russell says, most of the exchanges these days have automatic port protections in place that will either quarantine or shut down your port if anything comes in there that it shouldn't happen. And the switches these days are very good at managing this as well with the technology, being able to limit MACs, being able to shut down ports at a certain threshold. I guess we take them for granted, but they haven't always been there as technologies. Yeah, I think loops are something that continues to go on and causes an issue, but at least the vendors are aware of this these days, and the switches are kind of designed to have fail-safes in them so that something doesn't have anything more than the local impact, and it does get contained a lot better than it used to many years ago, at least. Technology as well. There is different things going on in this scene. I mean, it's always been evolving, but at the moment, there are some interesting things going on. VPLS has really come into its own lately, and VPLS is really good because you can do a lot of traffic engineering with it, and you can do some really funky failover mode stuff with it that you just couldn't do on a flat network or with a ring or a spanning tree. AMSIX is really the first exchange that's gone down the road of implementing this, which they did. They did a bit over a year ago now, and that was hugely successful. For them, they were hitting a technology hurdle where they were getting so big that they couldn't scale what they had. So they took a leap with the technology, and it's really paid off for them. But they were, you know, they took the risk as being an early adopter, but it has really worked out well. And what you're seeing now is other exchanges having seen the success of that. They're all reviewing their architecture, and they're looking at what their vendor is able to provide for them now. And I think you're going to see a lot more people starting to use VPLS. It seems to me a fairly logical evolution of the Ethernet LAN, really.
I'm not convinced about that. I have a bit of a problem with carriers and VPLS at the moment. I can't even trust my carrier to produce a decent invoice that doesn't require a full-time person to decode. How can I trust them to deliver a VPLS service that actually works? And in data centers, we're talking about sub-second convergence. And as a response to that, as an industry, the entire industry of the enterprise networking industry, is we've now moved to deploy technologies which are layer 2 over layer 3, which are done entirely locally within our own technology sets. And the reason that we do that is because we just do not trust our carriers to get it right. So I understand that VPLS has got some structural benefits from a carrier's point of view, but from an enterprise point of view, we think VPLS is knobs because carriers aren't to be trusted.
Firstly, I think you should change your carrier to somebody who can bill you correctly. But
well, you've just described every carrier in the UK.
Technology has flaws. Everything has flaws, and there's always going to be problems with things, but it's about how you use it. Most of the IXs have got extremely high standards. They're employing people who are the elite of the networking world that are doing this. The people have a lot of experience. They have a lot of knowledge. They have unprecedented access to the vendors and the technology. So you're dealing with people who are experts in doing this, which may differ from what is occurring within a corporate and enterprise or even a big telco, you know, where you may see some of these issues go on. But I think it's always the same with technology. I mean, just don't put all your eggs in one basket. VPLS works great, but, you know, don't go and peer at one exchange who just does VPLS and think that everything's going to be fine, because it's not going to be fine. At some point, there's going to be a problem, and that problem's going to affect you. So, you know, what's your plan? What actually is your contingency? And how does your network operate when something like this occurs? Maybe you want to be in a couple of different internet exchanges, maybe in the same city. Maybe you want to be in a couple of internet exchanges in different cities. Maybe you want to go for, if your IX has more than one LAN, connect to both LANs. And when you do it, try and be diverse in the technology that's being used to sort of eliminate the chance that if suddenly a bug appears somewhere, which we've seen in BGP, we've seen globally where bad BGP announcements have taken out particular vendors, routers all over the world. Well, if you don't want to be hit by that problem, connect to different things, use different technology, and make sure that you've got that level of protection in place. I think that's common sense when you build a network, but my observation of seeing how some people do build their networks and what they do, a lot of people.
I mean, the problem I have is that working with carriers is I'm building data centers or re-architecting data centers on a 10-week, 12-week timeline, 3 months, and I've got carriers and exchanges who can't respond within 6 months. Like I have carriers who can't deploy a circuit with less than 120 days. That doesn't include my provisioning time and my project time and my testing and all that. That's another 3 months on the end of the provisioning time. The time taken for carriers to deploy VPLS service is longer than the time I've got. By the time the carrier has deployed me a layer 2 service, the industry's moved on to the next generation.
Maybe. I think when you do this, I mean, there's a lot of different carriers. I think this is the sort of thing where it's worthwhile shopping around and maybe speak to some people who you may have dismissed earlier and see what they're doing now. Often it's a trade-off. The bigger, more well-known names tend to be stable, but the guys who you're probably describing, you know, they're the slower ones. Mm. And there's a lot of people out there in the space now who've got very good, robust networks and have very good turnarounds on delivering things for customers and a same or similar reliability.
Yeah. We're getting off topic a little bit, but it's a bit of a beef of mine because Layer 2 data center interconnects are really a hot topic at the moment and amongst the enterprise networking industry. And I just don't believe that VPLS is the way forward at this point in time until the carriers can actually prove they understand what response time is and manageability and transparency. And that's their industry. They haven't had to do any of that in the past, and networking has been allowed to let them get away with it. And they're going to be outclassed if we're doing, you know, with the new technologies coming through that just deprecate what a carrier does, what services they provide. It's going to be entertaining in the future.
Well, it still ties into the what I said before about strategy and diversifying. I mean, VPLS is very specific in what it does, and it usually it's very versatile, and it usually comes with a reasonable price point.
Yep.
But if you really want to make sure that, you know, if you're scared about it, take another circuit that isn't VPLS, get a wave of some sort, or, you know, a direct circuit and have two. And that's how you manage that kind of thing in my world.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds well and good, but that's not my experience. I've tried talking to my carriers about VPLS and they just look at me blankly. Somewhere inside the organization is somebody who knows what it is, but it's, you know, there might be three or four of them.
Blank responses are not encouraging from your supplier.
No, it's not. It's not a good look, is it, at all? Perhaps just to bounce back to a point that we had a little while ago, my understanding is that there's two types of internet exchanges. There's mutual types, which is the ones we've spoken about, but there's also commercial internet exchanges. Do you want to talk a little bit about those, Stephen?
Sure. Well, we were talking earlier about the mutuals, Link, SAM6, and these are exchanges that are owned by their members. And it's a common model that's used around the world, especially in Europe. It comes out of wanting to run infrastructure that's not for profit, wanting to have stability in the organization, removing the issues with having somebody who actually owns the IX. It also works well where the internet exchange is not necessarily tied to a particular colocation data center provider. And it seems to work well. Many of the mutuals are very old in internet terms, 10, 15 years old, and they continue to play a very central role in exchanging traffic on the internet. But as you mentioned, there's another, the opposite extreme is the commercial model. I'd say these were mainly popular in the US, come out of things like May East and May West, which were early internet exchanges that were really the hubs of the internet on the different coasts in the US. The Mays don't really exist these days, at least their legacy, but the model is still there. But what you see is that very often the co-location providers, these are Terramark, Equinix, Telex, CoreSite, these guys will actually operate their own IX. It's a religious thing, maybe, to say, you know, membership versus commercial org, which is best. I think really both have the pros and cons, and these vary a bit by the geography and the specifics of the region or the metro in which you're in, and your own requirement as to what you're looking for as well. My history is closely tied to the membership model, which I think works well, but the commercial model has proven itself just fine as well. I mean, all the names I just mentioned, they've got good track records, and they're certainly very large exchanges as well that play pivotal roles in their specific markets.
I think we've probably done the topic to death, I think we'll probably wrap it for the show for this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Stephen Wilcox for joining us on the show. What are you going to be doing this week, Stephen?
I'm booking plane tickets and flying around the world for business and pleasure.
An evasive answer. You can find out more about Stephen. There's some details about him in the show notes. And Russell, what's happening with you this week?
Well, I guess I'm going to be fairly busy at home this week. One of my my dogs had puppies on Friday, so I've been kept up all night with yelping dogs. So that's going to be keeping me busy at home. I guess I'll try and fit some time in somewhere to get another blog out this week. Not sure what my topic will be yet, but I'll try and make it a good one.
And you can find Russell's blog at pearlmonkey.blogspot.com. I'm guessing you used to do Perl a lot.
Yeah, I've always straddled the line a bit between sysadmin and networks. Certainly recently I've been more networks, but I do still try to keep my hand in with some of the scripting and sysadmin stuff.
I wish I had spent more time on that before I went into networking, but there you go. And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. Again, leave feedback on today's show and or email us, and we'd look forward to hearing from you. Or follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers or on Facebook at facebook.com/packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.